RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome, welcome, welcome to the Monday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with Tracy Beans. Yesterday, I recorded an amazing interview with Lee Smith, and Frank had his baby shower, so we weren't able to record together. But I want you guys to tune in for this. It's about his new book, The Permanent Coup, and it's really, really a great book. It is, oh gosh, it's everything. It's Spygate, it's China, it's Iran, it's Ukraine. It's all of those things lumped into one. And so settle back. It's always a great interview with Lee. I missed Frank very much, but we'll be back on Wednesday. Grab your popcorn, grab your coffee, take a listen to this amazing interview with Lee Smith. And the link to buy this fantastic book is in the show notes below. Off we go. So I am super excited to be joined by good friend of the show now, Lee Smith, who is out with a brand new book called The Permanent Coup. Lee, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Tracy, so much for inviting me. And I'm very flattered and honored you said I'm a good friend of the show. I like to think that, but it's nicer to hear the host of the show say it. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm glad you're here. You know, everything that we've talked about has come out to be sort of like prophecy in a way. Like, you know, when we talked last year, we were talking about the Avatar, and here we are.
Yeah.
So last interview we had together on the podcast, we talked about how Joe Biden, or you advanced the theory that Joe Biden is just an avatar for Barack Obama.
Yes.
And the book, which is, I mean, I just finished it literally 2 minutes ago, so it's very fresh in my mind. And it is just a masterful map of everything that's happened and what will be happening. What made you write this one?
That's really kind.
It's true. It's true.
Thank you. Well, because there's been so much stuff going on since, you know, the plot against the president basically ends when, you know, the congressman and the Objective Medusa team made the referrals, but it kind of ends after the 2018 midterms, you know, when the gavel goes over to the Democrats. I mean, there's stuff to follow up on. But what made me think about this book was all the things that have gone on since then. And so we're talking about the, you know, the nonsensical, equally nonsensical Ukraine gate stuff. We're talking about impeachment. We're talking about how the coronavirus was weaponized. We're talking about all of these different things, and they were all used. The press and Democratic officials used all of these things as instruments to target not just the president and actually not just his reporters, but also the Republic. I mean, and people asked, they said, well, what does that mean? I'm like, well, it means a couple of things. First of all, if you look at how this started with a massive surveillance campaign against the Trump candidacy, I mean, that's Banana Republic stuff. That's third world. That's not American, right? The last president who tried something like that, Richard M. Nixon, I mean, he now, his name has gone down in infamy, right? Even though Nixon was in many ways a good president, but because of what he did in Watergate, because he was attempting to spy on an opposing campaign, he rightly deserves to have that mark next to his name. And the idea, what we're looking at here, is that these were Obama spies. This was candidate Clinton, who were doing something even worse, because they were using the actual resources of the federal government, including active intelligence officers. So they used Obama spies to go after the Trump campaign, then the transition team, and then the presidency. So I just think that that's what a third world republic looks like, when this sort of stuff is naturalized and normalized. And you have the press, who's the essential platform, right? The thing about Watergate, the thing about other political scandals in our history, is that the press stands up and says, wait a minute, what's happened here? We need to start asking questions, and we need to start reporting the bad things, it appears, that someone someone, a campaign, a political institution has done. None of that has happened here, right? As you and I have spoken about frequently, the press partnered with the security services. And that's a common feature of third world regimes, where you have Ministry of Interior, meaning the spy services, and the Ministry of Information, meaning the nonsense that passes for journalism in dark and dangerous parts of the world.
You know, what scared me the most, believe it or not, even though I know this, but when you're involved in this stuff every single day, it gets a little hard to see the 30,000 foot view. And just reading through your book, realizing that the press is not even a separate entity. They are literally an agent of this coup.
Right.
Like they're functioning as like an enemy.
Yes. And
I mean,
it is amazing. It's amazing. And I again, when we hear people, you know, even people, you know, Republicans, conservatives, and they get on TV and say, the press is lazy, the press is complicit, why won't the press report that? I mean, I don't mean to badger people, but the essential point that we need to understand, not to simply to beat up on the operatives who are in the press, but to understand what we're up against, right? To say that this is an extremely dangerous moment. And I'll just rush ahead for a second, if you don't mind.
Nope.
But, you know, Congressman Nunes was speaking yesterday on the floor about the new mailbox hoax. And, you know, what he was saying was very funny and very sharp. And this is a guy who's been through the Russiagate ringer more than anyone. So his comments were great and very insightful. But I think that everyone also understands how serious it is they're doing, how stupendously dumb the mailbox conspiracy theory is. But they're preparing the groundwork for post-election conflict, right? They're delegitimizing the election beforehand. So that's what I mean. We have to understand what the press is really up to be able to prepare and to understand what our country looks like at this moment, and hopefully avoid bad things, hopefully avoid the dangers that we're being led into right now.
It's really, you know, after this whole Spygate thing, after the impeachment, you thought maybe you'd get a little respite, but it didn't happen. It just rolled into the next thing and rolled into the next.
Right.
I mean, is there ever a time when these people say, okay, you know, we've got to either, because they're going scorched earth.
Right.
We talked about this. There's nothing. I mean, it's blatant falsity at this point. They don't even care about objectivity or truth anymore at all.
Right.
What's their next step after this? I mean,
I think they're preparing for the election. They're delegitimizing. I mean, in the event that President Trump is reelected, they're delegitimizing the election, right? Oh no! He was stealing. He was eating mailboxes so that Biden voters were not able to cast their ballot for Biden.
So no one has a mailbox on the outside of their house, Lee. No one.
Right. Yeah. Right. And there's no post office. All the post offices have been shut down as well. Right. But you see the nonsense that they're pushing, and it's just idiotic. But again, if you see that this is how their message, this is the message that they are sending out to party faithful. And I'm not talking about the tens of millions, the hundreds of millions of normal, regular Americans who are just going out and they're casting their ballot. They're making their decision. They're making their choice. No, it's a very particular audience we're talking about. It's activists who are signaling to each other what the next step is going to be, what the play is. So that's extremely dangerous. And you talked before, I just want to swing back around to this. Sorry for jumping all over the place, but you talked about Biden as the avatar. I mean, this is precisely what we saw in the convention last week, where you have people who are wondering why Barack Obama said so little about his former vice presidential candidate, Joe Biden. I mean, well, that's one of the reasons, because it's Barack Obama's show. And if you saw any bits of the convention aside from Joe Biden speak, you realize that this is Joe Biden himself may be a moderate, right? Joe Biden doesn't want to defend the police. That's just a nutty right-wing conspiracy theory to say that old Joe wants to defund the police. As it turns out, the Democratic Party has embraced BLM, which wants to abolish the police and abolish prisons. And that's the way the party is going. It doesn't matter what Joe Biden thinks. The party Politburo has a very different idea about the way America should go. So, yeah, that's what I meant, that Joe Biden is the avatar for different, very powerful party interests.
I think that that's why they chose him to be the nominee, because he's malleable enough and doesn't have the chutzpah to do what he wants to do. He's
right, and he has a reputation as a moderate, right? So they can put a moderate out front. And when you see what's going on behind the scenes, when you see what's, you know, what's going on outside, it's a very different thing. It's kind of the reverse of the Wizard of Oz, right? The Wizard of Oz, you have the little guy behind the screen, and he's projecting all this different thing. Well, here you have the little guy outside, right? And the real machine works is what's going on. It's what's going on. The thousands of Democratic Party activists and the party leaders, those are the ones who are behind the curtain.
How many of the, you know, because yesterday we had those former national security folks come out and say, you know, you talk in the book about how even former military are kind of guiding policy. Yes. I think the second to last chapter, you talk about what happened when they walked to the church. Go into that a little bit for us.
Well, I mean, we've seen both active and former intelligence officials who have come out. I mean, both John Brennan, when John Brennan was in the Obama administration, and since then, you know, his social media presence and what he says on TV attacking the sitting president is insane. What we hadn't seen until the riots broke out was what former military officials were doing. So you had Trump's former Pentagon chief James Mattis, when he came out and wrote a short statement for the Atlantic magazine, and I explained that I think a lot of people misinterpreted what that statement was about. He wasn't simply attacking Trump. You know, he called them, likened him to the Nazis. I mean, just childish stuff. I mean, this was an adult who was responsible for the lives and fate of lots of people. So here he is comparing Trump to a Nazi, which is childish and stupid. But that statement was actually directed at Pentagon officials. It was directed at the civilian leader, Mark Esper, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, General Mark Milley. And that's why they backed off it. And that's why they said, yeah, I think it was a bad idea for me to walk across Lafayette Park in a show of resolve alongside the president of the United States, even though our country has been under attack from domestic terrorists the last several weeks. And in fact, they tried to burn down this church. So they got them to walk it back. That's extremely dangerous. If we're talking about people who are interfering with what's actually happening in the Pentagon and they're getting them to put distance between themselves and the president, that's destabilizing the American government.
I don't understand why they're still there, first of all. And not only that, I don't understand how we don't have, you know, people we can put in those positions with actual backbones, because how dare they do that? I mean, like, This is when you are watching the news every day, or you're on Twitter, or you're following social media, you're getting these stories one by one by one. But when you get a book like yours against the permanent coup, and we're with Lee Smith today, when you get a book like yours that puts it all together like that, after already laying the foundation with the first book, The Plot Against the President, it's terrifying what we're actually living through right now.
No, I agree. When I realized what Mattis had done, and how Milley and Esper had backed off, I'm like, this is very dangerous. And that's what I mean. We're moving into more dangerous times right before the election and after the election as well. And I'm worried, and I'm sure that many of your listeners are concerned as well. What did they do? I mean, I can tell you what they did. I mean, of course, I wasn't listening to the conversations that Mattis or whomever may have had with with Millie and Esper, but I can give you a pretty good sense of what they did. They threatened them. They said, look, Donald Trump is not forever. He's going to lose in 2020, or he'll be out in 2024. And when he is, you're going to pay a steep price for what you've done. You are not going to sit on any of the boards that people are accustomed to, the appointments that people are accustomed to getting after they leave an ace job like that, like Pentagon chief. And basically, you're not going to be able to put your children to school. You're lost. You've had it. Unless you put distance between yourselves and the president of the United States. That's how it works. That's why it's the swamp, right? Because of all of the different goodies that are dangled in front of people, and the idea that they're always putting the security and safety of the American public first. Unfortunately, it's not true. And this is no doubt one of the reasons why so many people are keen to target the current president of the United States. Because bizarrely, he appears to think that the interest of the United States, protecting and advancing them, that's his job. Bizarrely.
It's very strange. I mean, it's never happened before.
Yeah, as we look, yeah, you see, you talked about that letter signed by all those former Republican national security honchos. Look, I know a lot of those people. I worked for at least one of those people. And these were people who were rightly, or they positioned themselves as very pro-Israel. There are people on that list who actually raised money off of being pro-Israel and talking about the Iran nuclear deal, which is something I wrote about extensively
in the book.
I still write about it. And what do? These people now turn around and say how Donald Trump has weakened America. Donald Trump is not a good foreign policy leader. And if you just look at one small bucket of American foreign policy, the Middle East, what has he done? I mean, he moved the embassy to Jerusalem. He recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, recognized Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights. He got out of the nuclear deal with Iran. He killed a madman, Qasem Soleimani. I'm like, these are all important victories that help advance the American interest and help our allies, which advances the American interest. And these clowns, these vicious clowns who turn around and write something like this, of course, no one's really paying attention, right? There aren't voters who are paying attention.
No, that's not what it was for.
Right, exactly. They don't care what someone who's like the number 15 guy at the State Department, they don't care what this person says, right? The regular voter, thank goodness. Right. But it's about what's supposed to circulate in Washington. It's supposed to be threats for other people who would join the Trump administration. It's very nasty. It's very ugly what these people are up to.
And not only that, but what interests are they after if not, you know, supporting what has already happened, especially
their own.
Yeah. Or is there something greater? Are they on board with that Obama globalism sort of a mantra? Even I was so happy to hear you talk about George Bush number one and what he brought us into with globalism. So that's an undercurrent. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, you know, this is George H.W. Bush, who in lots of ways, in almost every way, was a fantastically impressive figure. I mean, right. He was a World War II pilot, a hero. He was head of the CIA, ambassador to China, vice president, and president, an enormously accomplished man, but had very strange ideas about the world. I mean, it's probably useful for us to go back and imagine. Well, look, we call it the Cold War, but it was extremely deadly. There were a lot of people around the world, including Americans, who died during this nearly half century long conflict with the Soviet Union. So I think in lots of ways, they must have welcomed the idea of a peaceful interlude. And that's what this would lead into, a world without borders, a world without conflict, a world where everyone was trading with each other, right? I mean, this is the hortatory language of the New York Times. We see this all the time. Oh, no one makes war against people that they trade with, unfortunately, it's just not true, right? It was nice to imagine that's what the world looks like, but it's just not true. The problem is not so much George H.W. Bush. The problem is, why did it take nearly a quarter of a century for a president to stand up and say, you know, this is not good for the American public. It's not good for American workers. It's not good for American industry. And the fact that we don't make our penicillin here is extremely bad for American national security, right? That we don't make these vital goods that are important for the health, at the very least, the health of the American public. This is very bad. So Donald Trump steps up, and this is one of the things that got that has made him, that has put him in the crosshairs of the masters of the swamp, right? How dare Trump talk about this? Everyone is rolling in dough, right? Everyone is doing very well with all the different trade deals with China. We're American voters, we're American workers. No, of course not. But were people in Washington making a lot of money processing Chinese Communist Party money? Absolutely, 100%.
You know, reading there's a bit about Feinstein in there, which I was happy about. Mm. And, how her and her husband kind of enriched themselves. And I had done a lot of research around this and Chinese influence. And the way they do it, and you talk about this in the book, is they buy you off after you leave office.
Right.
You don't necessarily need to be in office, although that happens too. But they go for you after you leave because of your influence afterwards.
Right.
They did it in Australia too.
Right. We see different people. I mean, sadly, you know, Joe Lieberman, who is the Democratic candidate for vice president, and, you know, former Senator Lieberman has a fantastic reputation. But, you know, he's taking money to lobby on behalf of a Chinese telecom that has ties to the Communist Party's military and intelligence services. So, look, I mean, that's what Washington is about, frankly. It's about foreign people, and this is one large component of Washington, foreign people coming to Washington to try to advance their interests. That's just the way, that's how superpowers work. However, there must be some time when American policymakers, when former American policymakers, statesmen like Henry Kissinger turn around and say, wait a minute, maybe this isn't working. It appears that we're getting the short end of the stick here. One person who did do that phenomenally is Richard M. Nixon. Not long before he died, he wondered if maybe they hadn't made a mistake. They gambled on the idea they were going to be able to bring China into the community of responsible nations. Has that happened? We saw when the Chinese directed death outward to the rest of the world, right? This was the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. Uh-huh. Right, when the Chinese cut down or they cut off internal travel from Wuhan, but allowed planes and other travel to leave Wuhan. It's like that is hard to think of what's a less responsible act than what the Chinese Communist Party did with that.
You know, your book got the closest to a theory that I've had about this entire virus that I've read.
Okay.
I'm going to share it with you. It's based on nothing other than like my like mind going, right? So China has this virus that they know is new. It's a novel virus, but they know that it's not ridiculously deadly other than in certain groups. So they lock their country down and weld people into their houses to make it look outwardly as though this is like Ebola. And then every other nation is watching China do this and says, oh my gosh, what do they know that we don't know?
Interesting.
And then follow suit. And I mean, what better way to destabilize the entire world, including your biggest rival in America, than to do that? And now you've got politicians in your pocket as China as well. You know, you've got people doing your bidding. So you touched, you know, you didn't say it like that, obviously. But tell me what your thoughts are about that little theory of mine.
I think it's very interesting. That had not occurred to me. I think it's very interesting. But of course, I mean, we've seen that the way that people understand. There was some study that came out earlier this week, I believe, from Franklin Templeton, and saying how younger people especially totally misunderstood and overstated by
tens of millions,
by a manifold factor, right? How dangerous COVID-19 was for people under the age of, you know, people in their 20s and 30s, right? It's just, it's, I mean, look, of course it's bad. People have gotten sick. Many people have died. It's terrible, right? But the idea that people have misunderstood it, and that how it has been intentionally misreported. Yeah, I mean, well, let me just, you're talking in some ways about the heart of the book, which is series of information operations. So here's an interesting information operation where the American press dovetails perfectly with the Chinese Communist Party, right? The Chinese Communist Party understands how sensitive Americans are to being called racist, right? And that's why when you heard all of these different people, when, you know, when Trump would say, like, yeah, I call it the, you know, the China flu or the Chinese flu or the Wuhan virus, right? And people would turn around and accuse him of racism. There are over the last 6 months, absolutely, Chinese information operations, Chinese propaganda has intersected with the interest and the messaging of the Democratic Party, meaning the press. So yeah, this is actually shocking. I mean, the Chinese do a number of different things. I mean, one of the other things they've done is they promote this idea that the rise of China, the Chinese giant, is inevitable. It's foolish for people to stand in the way. It's much better if you get on board now. There will be rewards for people who understand the inevitability of the ascent, the rise of China. And there will probably be punishments for people who do not get on board now. So, and this is, you know, again, this dovetails perfectly with what a lot of the press is saying about China and how we've understood China for many years. I think people must be shocked, right? And it's like, wait a second. I just thought that they were supposed to be like capitalists. They just wanted to make money. And it appears that's not the same. It appears that's not what's happening.
There's an underlying war going on with China right now that most Americans don't even know is happening. I mean, you know, we're arresting them left and right. They've infiltrated our CIA. They've infiltrated our government. They're sitting in as drivers for longstanding members of the Senate. They're burning papers outside of their consulates. I mean, this is something else. And
oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, you know, this is it's not it didn't happen directly. But, you know, people have been foolishly captivated by this Russiagate conspiracy theory since 2016. And what's been happening since then? I mean, we have a very serious, I'm not to entirely downplay the threat that Russia plays, but I mean, China is the major intelligence threat. It's the major military threat. It's the major economic threat. And what's happened? People have entirely downplayed this, ignored it, or covered it up. And so you see the disastrous results that this Russiagate conspiracy theory have had in so many different ways. Distract the attention of the American public. Well, there are very serious threats to us. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and you know, China even almost threatened Five Eyes. I mean, they almost broke up Five Eyes over Huawei, from my understanding of it anyway.
Right.
I mean, there were literally Five Eye countries that were like, no, we're not using this technology. So, and it was an argument, and they were able to, you know, I think Mike Pompeo's done a really great job as a Secretary of State, and then putting him in the CIA first, I think, was fantastic because he really got a taste for what was going on. And, you know, I definitely want to touch on the whole Spygate portion of this because it is such a big deal. But the underlying story between Ukraine and China and all the other things that are going on. Let's talk about Ukraine for a little bit.
Yes. OK.
What a great synopsis of that you did in the book.
Thanks. Well, I mean, the case I wanted to make is, well, first, I mean, the most important thing, the title, subtitle, Have Enemies Foreign and Domestic Targeted the American President. The problem with our foreign enemies, as Trump has himself said, it's like, yeah, I don't really blame China for ripping off America. I mean, that was the fault of our policymakers, our leaders. They're supposed to be responsible for protecting American interests, and they did not. It's the same thing in this case with Ukraine, because what happened with Ukraine was they were drawn in, right? They were drawn in by the Democrats in 2016, and they did help. They did, they did interfere in the 2016 election. So I know that the way the media and the Democratic Party is messaging this, that it's all part of a Russian disinformation campaign. It's all lies. It's all nonsense. Well, look, it was reported by their people and their publications, like the New York Times and like Politico. If they want to go full on Stalinist and start disappearing people, right? The authors of these articles and the articles themselves. Okay, then let's be clear about what they're doing. They're flushing this stuff. They're flushing facts down the memory hole. These things actually happened. There were Ukrainian officials, Ukrainian activists who were drawn into the 2016 election by Democratic Party officials. This is a fact. So I think we've talked about this before. The way to understand what we've seen here over the last 4 years is you have to knock everything down to its foundations. And what the foundations are, it's timeline and quotes, right? Once you know what people are saying and what they're doing, the press's job is to fill it in with all this garbage that uses as mortar to prop up these narratives. But the facts are all there. The facts have been reported, again, oftentimes by their publications, by their people. They're shocked when it comes out and when people realize, when people go back to New York Times story from December 8th, 2015, and they see the New York Times reporting on the problems that Joe Biden has because his son Hunter is working for a corrupt company in Ukraine. Wow, that just floors people. But this was reported by the New York Times. Joe Biden himself has said it. He bragged about it in front of a New York audience, January 2018. Yeah, so I went to the Ukrainians, says Joe Biden, and I told them they're not going to get $1 billion loan guarantee. In other words, $1 billion worth of U.S. taxpayer money. So I'm using the resources of the federal government as leverage to make a special request that benefits me personally from the Ukrainian president, right? It sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And that reflection portion that you're talking, I mean, they literally just turned it around on the president of the United States.
Right. That's, I mean, politically and psychologically, it kind of makes sense, right? It's like, oh, no, Tracy, you say that I'm a Russian asset. You're the real Russian asset. That's what they do. And that's how that's what they made impeachment out of. So they turned it on President Trump, and also they buried what Joe Biden did. So now no one will talk about what Joe Biden did and what his son Hunter did. I mean, it's outrageous, right? Yeah. Ukraine, we can all agree, is a notoriously corrupt country. But astonishingly, the only person that Joe Biden wanted fired in this famously corrupt country is the guy who was investigating the company his son was drawing $80,000 a month from. I mean, it's laughable, right?
It certainly is. And, you know, there's been advancement there, too, Lee. We've got some of the people with Privat going through some issues. You know, these things are going on quietly behind the scenes. People think nothing's happening, I have to say. I mean, from what I'm seeing, things are happening. We're just not being inundated with leaks about them.
Right.
And so that's one thing. But what you said about Ciarmella was great, too, because there was a whole bunch about him and where he came up and what he was doing. And you had some insiders telling you some stuff there, and unnamed insiders. What was it like talking to those folks? Because some of them were Obama appointees, right?
Yeah, they worked in the Obama administration. Well, they had very good insight into the different things that were going on in the Obama administration, especially some of the stuff touching on Ukraine. Yeah, the point I wanted to make with Eric Ciarmella is that while he eventually became famous as the whistleblower, and no one was supposed to say this name, I mean, he is an intelligent bureaucrat, right? From the CIA, he was another anti-Trump operative. Washington is full of them, right? So somehow that this person should be protected because he wanted to target the president of the United States. How do you get away with that? Well, you only get away with that, again, if the press is 100% the wind in your sails, right? So this guy had made several runs at President Trump and Trump officials. So of course, this is going to be the guy who's going to be behind the, you know, behind the fraudulent whistleblower's complaint.
The whistleblower complaint, it's interesting because you talk about the transcript and releasing the transcript, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that I kind of speculated about, and I was waiting for more information. It seems like you've gotten your hands on some emails and stuff like that. But one of the things that I was saying is that they moved that transcript to a secure server, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't supposed to be done. It was a mistake. I don't think so. I think they were going to alter that transcript. And that's why that whistleblower story came out the way it did. You know, Vindman had his paws all over that transcript. He was the one who was altering parts of it anyway. Then they moved it and he was like, oh, shoot.
Right.
What do you think?
I think one of the big concerns is, well, I don't know if they were going to alter it, but I'll tell you one thing. I mean, one of the things that Congressman Nunes talks about in this book, and he's talked about it before, is the number of leaks of classified intercepts. So we're talking about certainly the most important one is, or the best known one is, General Flynn's conversation with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. But that's not the only one. I mean, they leaked Trump's conversation with the Australian prime minister and the Mexican president to embarrass Trump. But I mean, that's just astonishing. So the president, the whole point is, the larger point was that the president is not allowed to conduct foreign policy, right? He can't conduct foreign policy. He can't speak with foreign leaders. That was their basic point. The smaller, minor point is to keep trying to embarrass Trump, to keep trying to embarrass the administration, to destabilize and disorient them. And that too is part of the, that too is part of the coup. But so if they did, if they were worried about this transcript, they may have been worried it would have been altered. That's possible, I guess. But I think the big concern was that, again, this was something else that was going to be leaked. And in a sense, of course, it was leaked. And the idea that the president had to release the entire transcript to prove his innocence because he'd been targeted by another operation coming out of a CIA official, a Pentagon official, it's just insane. I think that even our colleagues, our friends, your listeners, it's hard for us to understand the level of chaos that these people have created, these Americans have created in their own country, and what they're pushing us toward. It's astonishing.
It is astonishing. Let's talk a little bit about a little bit about Brennan now, since we're moving.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're moving towards the CIA. So you do a couple things. You identify what the insurance policy is, but also we talk a lot about Brennan in the book. So what did you learn that you didn't know before when you were doing research for this?
Yeah. I think it's not so much what I didn't know before. I think it's just the different things that, you know, we're all lucky because the amounts of information that keep coming out help us put together different pieces. So we have clearer insight now. Some of the times actually, you know, whatever. Now we know, for instance, that Igor Danchenko was the fake primary subsource. So we know we have that. But there's other information that comes from that declassification that will help us figure out other things. So it's great to have more information coming out. We can put together other things. So it struck me that John Brennan has been demanding credit since at least May 2017 for initiating the FBI's bogus investigation of Trump. And I decided to take him at his word. I said, well, maybe he does deserve credit. So looking through different comments that Brennan has made, the different things that Brennan has leaked to the press, it has become increasingly clear that it's true. John Brennan is at the center of what became what we now know as the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. I believe that John Brennan played a central part in starting that investigation and starting the targeting of the Trump campaign.
So yesterday, or Friday, I'm sorry, supposedly now, John Brennan spent about 8 hours at CIA headquarters with John Durham's team.
Yeah.
And his spokesperson from the CIA at the time came out and gave a statement about how he's been, he's not a target and, you know, all this stuff. And it was interesting that his spokesperson did that. And Shipwrecked Crew wrote an article for Red State. I don't know if you saw.
I did. I thought it was very, very interesting. Yeah.
And what do you think about the way that Brennan handled his PR after this whole interview?
Well, I mean, I learned a lot from that article too. I thought it was great. And this has been one of the joys is, you know, I think we've spoken about this before about reporting this story. We get to learn a whole bunch of different things that we didn't know. So I thought it was very insightful and very helpful. I mean, what struck me was, the first thing that struck me was, okay, it's an 8-hour interview. And I mean, all right. I mean, that's a lot of time, right? And so that struck me as very significant. If we're just going through different details, you need 8 hours for that. You're not just saying, so yeah, just, you know, we talked to a whole bunch of people about how you put together that intelligence community assessment. I just want to check this with you again. And, you know, they said you got this person and that person, you use this and that. 8 hours is a long time.
8 hours is very long time.
8 hours, that's right out of a cop movie, right? When they've got the bright light on someone, you know, it's like, bud, get him a glass of water.
Let's keep him in there.
It just seems that's a long time, right? For someone who ostensibly wasn't really involved in this. If he's not really involved in it, why 8 hours, right? It tells me at the very least that John Brennan must have had a lot of information, and they must have asked a lot of questions of John Brennan during that 8-hour period.
What is John Brennan's connection to Stefan Halper, if any?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. You know, my understanding is that a lot of people who work at the CIA never took Stefan Halper very seriously, perceived him as, well, I mean, what is he? I mean, one of the things in this book, it's in chapter 4 called October Surprises. And I just put together what Halper's about. And everyone can look it up in the IG report. I just looked at yesterday. I think it's like page 317 to 318, right? Halper goes in there. He's talking to Carter Page. He's asking about the October surprise, right? Hey, does the campaign have an October surprise? Boy, if we had those emails, we would have used them back in my day. So it's a political operation. That's what it is. It's not an investigation. It was never an investigation. It was 100% a political operation to find out if candidate Donald Trump had an October surprise that he found among Hillary Clinton's 3,000 nominally deleted emails. That's what it was. It was never an investigation at all. So you see that, and you see the questions that Halper's asking, like, okay, this is nothing. This is not, as we all know, it's not an investigation, but they're quite open about it. It was a political operation. So would someone like John Brennan have tapped someone like Stefan Halper, knowing that Halper is a political activist, an operative, not really a confidential informant? Yeah, I certainly think that's possible. I mean, that's Halper's reputation. That's what he did with the Reagan campaign. It appears that that's what he's done most of his career. He's just a political operative.
And he was also successful in getting the information about General Flynn to David Cramer and the McCain wing of the establishment.
Right.
He passed that. Cramer testified to that in front of the HPC. He actually talked about General Flynn and Svetlana Lakova. And so I think that, you know, we haven't heard much about Brennan being involved in this kind of plot against Flynn, but he's involved in everything else.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I spoke to a number of people, which I document in the book, former CIA people, actually, who point out that the CIA itself, I mean, with General Flynn, the thing with General Flynn is there were many people who were looking to go after him, right? The FBI had reasons. The CIA's reason for going after him was a very important paper he wrote in 2010 called Fixing Intel.
Yep.
Now, one of my sources says that this represented a an existential threat to the CIA, because it was going to change. I mean, this man was going to be national security advisor, and he was going to revamp the intelligence community. That was going to affect the CIA. It was going to affect their budgets. It was going to affect their personnel. So yes, absolutely, John Brennan, that's all he's ever done, worked at the CIA. He's started a private company called the Analysis Company for a brief period.
Yeah.
But I mean, this guy started with the CIA very, very early on. So yes, I think that the big wigs at the CIA, I think they must have been very concerned about that, about General Flynn and what General Flynn was intending to do when he was coming in. I'll just finish up on General Flynn for a second. But as I report in the book, I mean, the Obama administration also wanted, they were also targeting General Flynn. And that's because as both he and Donald Trump on the campaign trail had expressed their shock that the Obama administration would legalize the nuclear weapons program of a terrorist state, Iran. They were determined to undo the nuclear deal with Iran. And of course, this was Barack Obama's signature foreign policy initiative. This was in many ways his legacy. So when General Flynn is talking about undoing this deal, right, that's what kicked off Obama. And Obama was protecting his foreign policy legacy.
And the foreign policy legacy of Obama weaves its way into that bigger picture we were talking about earlier of globalism and you know, everything else. And he's like desperate for these plans to continue. And the American people are saying, I don't think so. You know, what were we thinking for all these years? We're awake now. Look at all the stuff that's going on. We can't have this. And so they must be like very disappointed. But General Flynn is a very big part of your book. And you know, we've got a little bit of time left, but I want to talk about the epilogue because it was just very touching.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I thought it was really moving. I have, a statement from General Flynn, contacted him, and he talks about the coup. He talks about, I think the most moving thing was, it's not a government we're fighting for, which means it's not just the Trump administration. It's not just about our political preferences, whether we're Democrats or Republicans, right? It's about our country. It's about an idea. It's about individual liberties. It's about communities and families. And that's finally what the coup is really about. It's people who are targeting the way that we as Americans live, right? The promotion and protection of individual liberties. So I think that, you know, General Flynn put it extremely well, and thanks for mentioning that, Tracy. It's a really, it's a very moving statement. I want to say something else very important about General Flynn and the role he plays in the book. I think that, you know, I think you and I have probably talked about this before, but the number of documents that were declassified the last several months, starting I guess the end of April, is when we saw the list of all the Obama administration officials who had unmasked General Flynn's name from the transcripts of classified intercepts. And going until, I guess, the end of June, where we saw declassification of a document where Barack Obama had told then FBI Director James Comey to investigate Flynn. Right. One of the astonishing things, this is another reason that I think it was important to write this book, The Permanent Coup, is because we've been talking for nearly 4 years now about the deep state and about the different bad things the deep state has done. And they have done bad things. Right. But it's important now that we pull back. I don't know how we put in cinematic language, if we pull the camera back some and pan. We see it wasn't the deep state, right? The deep state was an instrument. The people who were behind this, the people who were behind the targeting of General Flynn, right? These were, according to documents that have been declassified, these were the two highest office holders in the land, Barack Obama and Joe Biden. This was coming out of the White House. So that in itself, I think that in itself is a very important thing that we need to discuss more. It wasn't just the deep state, right? That's, if you look now at the plea deal made by Kevin Kleinsmith, it's quite clear Kevin Kleinsmith is not calling the shots.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't say, let's go after Carter Page. Let's go after Trump. It's not the bureaucrats at the mid-level. It's not even the bureaucrats at the high level.
Well, they're willing participants, but they're not calling the shots.
Exactly. No, they're happy to do it. Right. I mean, these are gross people. Right. But they're not the ones who are calling the shots. Now, with the declassification of these documents, we understand. I think a lot of people must have had suspicions beforehand, but now it's mind boggling to see the evidence of it. It's like, wow, it really was the 44th president of the United States who was saying that the incoming national security advisor should be investigated.
Everybody's qualm is then, well, nothing's ever going to happen to this guy. Obama's never going to face accountability for what he did. And it's clear Bill Barr is not going to be going after Obama, regardless of what he finds, which is a very sad thing because, it's kind of disappointing to think about that. But what do you think will happen if, do you think that this is going to roll out to taint his legacy, even with a lapdog media, or is he just going to sail off into the sunset unlike Nixon?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, I should say something about the, we would need to get someone here our friend Shipwreck Crew or Andy McCarthy or Mark Walk, people who understand how investigations work and stuff like this. And I don't. But my sense is that while the attorney general has said, Mr. Obama and Mr. Biden are not, they're not being investigated. Look, it changes. If someone gets on a stand or somewhere and says, well, hey, it wasn't me. Right. Well, who told you to do this? Right. And that's basically what Comey is saying. Right. That's what the declassification of that document is. Comey's saying it wasn't me. It looked to me like the phone call between Flynn and Kislyak was legit.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that actually plays out during the course of an investigation. Just because someone says we're not investigating them doesn't mean that you give them a free pass if you find out they've broken the law. And that, I don't think that means that the 44th president of the United States is going to wind up in an orange jumpsuit anytime soon. I'm happy for, as you say, for people to understand the destructiveness of that legacy, how he was and remains today an agent of chaos. And Americans, I think that the important thing is for America to return to some sort of sense of normalcy however people vote should not be the key thing. We should be able to have important debates about how we live here among each other and how we project influence abroad. But again, the chaos that Barack Obama and that administration left our country with, and this is again what the coup is about. This is what they did. This was not by mistake. And this is not, I know the press is happy to color it this way. This is not what Donald Trump is doing. To say, for instance, I think it's important that we have, a border and that we don't allow people to come into the country illegally. And for people to turn around and say that's racist, right. That's the immediate response. Donald Trump says he wants to protect American jobs, ergo racist.
Yeah.
It's nonsensical, right?
Yeah.
But this is part of the chaos we've been left with.
So why did you choose just to close out here? Because it's been a very quick hour, my goodness.
Yeah. Really? Thank you, Tracy. No, it's always great to talk to you. It's always a lot of fun.
Ditto. Why did you choose Permanent Coup as the title?
I thought, because that, well, first of all, it refers kind of to two things. It refers to the now apparently endless succession of information warfare operations targeting Donald Trump, whether it's collusion, the Russiagate, into the Mueller special counsel. And from there, that rolls into Ukrainegate, which turns into the impeachment process. Which turns into, and again, all these things fall on each other. It's amazing. Right.
COVID, then post office.
That's where we are right now, post office. Right. So it refers partly to that. But permanent, I say, because that's the effort. The effort is to overturn, is to change the nature and the character of the country. And if you want to know what they're trying to turn it to, right, we've seen this unfolding on our streets the last several months, sending out frontline DNC militias like BLM, like Antifa. That's their vision of this country, right? That's how things are solved, through spying, not how things are solved, rather, but how a very narrow slice of the American polity, that's how their interests are advanced, by putting opponents under surveillance, by destroying American cities, by acts of terror, by acts of intimidation and threat. So that's why it's permanent, right? Because that's how important the fight is. If they do change the nature and the character of the country, that's what we're up against. And the book is about then. It's about different people. It starts in chapter Cloud of Dust with Congressman Nunes. And it starts with Americans asking, who's fighting for us? Who's fighting for the country? We know Congressman Devin Nunes is. We know Donald Trump is. So the book is about other people who are fighting. That's the Flynn family. That's the president's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. So it's a number of different people who understand what's going on, how important this time is. And look, the other thing that I think is really moving is going around and talking to people in California, especially because that's where chapter one starts. It's like, you see how people are actually inspired, right? It's a rough time, but people are kind of inspired and moved to be living in a meaningful time.
Yeah.
Because I think that Americans are very keen and very eager to be able to defend their country. I'm not talking about violence. I'm saying, like, to stand up for what their country, what they believe their country stands for, to make their affection, their patriotism known. So again, it's a rough time. And I think that before and after the election, it will be dangerous, but it's a great time. I think that people really feel lucky and blessed and privileged that we're alive now, and that we get to speak our minds and stand up for our country and what it represents.
That's beautiful. I like that. Because everybody is very, cognizant of what, for example, quickly, I was at the mall yesterday with my daughter school shopping. I came out of the mall. I took the stupid mask off my face and I looked at her and I said, isn't it great to be able to breathe? Right. Yeah. And I walked about 30 feet and an older woman came up to me and said, oh, isn't it great to be able to breathe? Like right after. And she was, please pray for our president. She had no idea what my politics were.
Oh, wow.
It was really incredible.
That's very sweet.
It was,
it's not just breathing, but another thing, it's like you look around and you go around here, we live in Washington, you go around and you see young people wearing masks, like they're out jogging or they're out on their bicycles or something like that. And it's nutty, but there's something else in addition to the breathing. And that is, like, that's what community is supposed to be. Like, you can see someone's face, you see someone smile.
They're ruining it. I know.
We're missing the human smile. The human smile is one of the most important features of the human experience, period. Right. And now everyone has their face covered. We're supposed to look at Joe Biden and people like, mandatory mask mandate. Well, for how long? And for what purpose?
Forever and right? For no reason.
It's just sick, right? No, we're just going to take away the human face. We're just going to take away expressions of joy or, of course, sadness or anger. But that's what the human face is. But again, for the last 6 months, we've had people who have been arguing for covering up the human face for totally irrational and anti-scientific reasons. So, it's hitting us in every possible way. But again, I think that people want to rise to the occasion.
Yep. To end on a positive note, everybody go out and get this book. It is absolutely fantastic. The Permanent Coup, how enemies foreign and domestic targeted the American president, by Lee Smith. Just another great job. Oh,
yeah.
The movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I can't believe I waited till the very end for this. But the plot against the president has been, like, morphed into this film.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're making a documentary, and I hope, I know you've seen the trailer, and I bet a lot of your listeners have seen it too. I haven't seen it. They interviewed me, and actually, it was only at the end that I said, oh yeah, actually I have an insight or two that might be helpful. But I just looked at the trailer. I'm like, wow, this looks great. I can't wait to see it. I think it looks really terrific. And the plan is to have it out, before the election. I hope sometime in October. The person who's made the film, is a woman named Amanda Milius, and Amanda worked at the State Department, and she's a filmmaker. She's made other films, and her father is a famous filmmaker whose name is John Milius, who made Red Dawn and wrote Apocalypse Now. So yeah, I couldn't be more honored than to have them making a movie out of Plot Against the President. So yeah, it's very exciting. Thank you for raising that.
Yeah, everybody go out. If you haven't gotten that book yet, I don't know what the hell you're waiting for, just to be frank. And it's for real. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to link the book. Yeah, everybody buy it. Again, I wouldn't recommend a book if it wasn't fantastic. I was glued to it for days.
Kind.
So it's true.
Thank you.
It's true.
That's very kind.
Thanks, guys. And I told you it would be great. I told you it would be great. Thanks for sticking around for the whole show. Again, Wednesday, we have Ned Ryan joining us on the show. Excited to talk to him. And you have been listening to the Dark to Light podcast with only Tracy Beans today. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and RadioInfluence.com. We will see you on Wednesday. I don't have a later for you today. See you guys Wednesday.
This is a Lawfather Podcast quick fix on Radio Influence.
As always, I try to bring a tie-in to Florida here. I am a Florida attorney, and I don't practice anywhere other than Florida. So one of the first things that we want to look at is the wrongful death statute. Now, every state, either they have a wrongful death statute or they don't. I know Florida does, because we're going to look at that here real quickly. But like I said, this part of it is solely related to Florida, and it talks about what the survivor's rights are. Okay. Now, if you are a single individual and you don't have any family, then there is no mechanism for a wrongful death case. So just kind of keep that in mind. It sounds kind of weird, right? Because maybe somebody did truly do something wrong, and really you truly should be able to recover something. But if there's nobody to recover it on your behalf, there's nothing there. And you may say, well, what if you had a will that named somebody a beneficiary, right? The recipient of whatever funds you had at the time of your death. Well, the wrongful death statute doesn't apply to that, because the calculation comes down to the family relationship and what you could do for it. So what we look at is, and I'm going to read the statute, then we'll break it down some, is that each survivor may recover the value of loss support and services from the date of the decedent's injury to his or her death with interest, and future loss of support and services from the date of death and reduced to present value. Now, what does that mean, right? What does any of that mean other than that the survivors may recover the value of loss support and services? Well, what are loss support and services? Basically, right, if you're a parent, what do you provide to your kids? Do you go out and play with them? Do you go out and you have to work three shifts to put food on the table? Or do you, somewhere in the middle of all that, some combination of all those things?
The Lawfather Podcast can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.